technology claims another victim.
As another American institution files for bankruptcy.
From APM American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Adrian Hill.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. You're listening to the Marketplace Midday Update, our podcast from Marketplace.org. Today is Thursday, January 19th. Coming up, through thick and thin, Europeans are sticking by the euro.
And the high-stakes debate over a single second.
Plus another piracy fight, although this time it involves real-life sea pirates.
Those stories and more just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
Eastman Kodak filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection this morning. It's just the latest high-profile company to go bankrupt in recent weeks following American Airlines and Hostess Brands. So what's going on? Here's Marketplace's Amy Scott.
All these companies face their own predicaments in a changing world. Kodak has been struggling to reinvent itself in the age of digital photography. David Skeel teaches bankruptcy law at the University of Pennsylvania. He says companies that have filed for bankruptcy recently do have one thing in common: the economy.
In a time of austerity, the companies that are most vulnerable are the ones that are most likely to fall. And I think each one of those companies had long-standing problems, and the difficulties caused by the recession, I think, brought them to a head.
Now they'll be trying to restructure and find new revenue in a tough environment. Kodak hopes to raise cash by selling a portfolio of digital imaging patents and to reemerge as a much leaner printer and ink company. It's already closed 13 factories and more than 100 processing labs. It's cut 47,000 jobs since 2003. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
It's hard to see Kodak's bankruptcy as all that surprising. Digital cameras, the cameras on our phones, they've changed the way we think about our picture taking. Kodak is one of a string of companies that haven't been able to keep up with new technology. Joining us now is Henry Blodgett. He's the editor of Business Insider. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So we've seen Borders, Blockbuster, and now Kodak, all businesses that just didn't keep up with technology. What industries or companies do you think are next?
Well, I think certainly the media industry is in trouble and figuring out what it's going to do. Obviously, we've seen newspapers have to radically change their models. I don't think there's any question that the internet will continue to create havoc with traditional industries, and you'll probably see more companies like Blockbuster.
How can old tech companies stay relevant?
I think when you have a change as radical as the one that destroyed Kodak, it is extremely difficult. Basically, a new technology came along and it eliminated the need for their core product. People don't sell film for digital photography. People like to say that the companies were stupid or they missed something. I think the truth is that the market changed and they just simply did not change quickly enough.
Is there an industry out there that everyone says is going away that you actually think will make it?
I think the TV industry is surprising a lot of people with its resilience. For the last 5 to 10 years, everybody has been saying network TV is toast. People like to watch shows now. They don't care about NBC or ABC. They're just going to watch their favorite shows, and the cable industry will disintegrate. And it turns out that people are actually very willing to pay for the convenience of having a big pipe bring in everything into their house. And even as cable bills keep going up and up and up, people still are willing to pay for that. There is still this argument about what will happen to TV, but right now it's surprising people with its strength.
Henry Blodgett is editor of Business Insider. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
We've got a big drop in the number of people seeking unemployment benefits this morning. The number of people that applied for unemployment benefits fell by 52,000 last week to 352,000. That's the lowest level in almost 4 years. Diane Swonk is chief economist with Mesirow Financial. She joins us from Chicago, as she does every Thursday. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, what do you make of this big drop in the jobless number after last week's relatively high number?
Well, of course, no month, no week is a trend, but I think there's a couple things going on. One, we saw the Martin Luther King holiday, which prevented some people from filing in states like California, but the trend is nonetheless good in the private sector. What we're starting to see is more public sector layoffs not coming from cuts at the state and local level, but now coming from cuts at the federal level, both postal employees now being cut and veterans returning home and applying for more unemployment insurance.
And Diane, I want to get your thoughts on the other big economic indicator that came out this morning. Consumer prices, according to the Consumer Price Index, didn't change a bit last month. There's still no price inflation going on.
Exactly. What we saw was consumers, everything from prices at the pump falling, but really consumers being savvy about their holiday shopping and deep discounts, shopping for those discounts. Where there were price increases, ironically enough, were where there's money in the corporate sector. Corporations giving big, more lavish holiday parties and entertaining more. That's where you saw a little more inflation this last month.
Diane Zwong, Chief Economist with Mesirow Financial. Thanks, as always.
Thank you.
On Tuesday, President Obama will give his State of the Union address. He'll no doubt tackle the economy, where it is today, how to grow it, which brings us to our weekly attitude check.
And the latest poll number suggests
margin of error.
There is somewhat of a disconnect.
It's conventional wisdom.
Our survey said.
We want to know how Americans are feeling about the state of their union and the economy. So we turn to Frank Newport, as we do every week. He's the editor-in-chief at the polling firm Gallup. Good morning, Frank.
Good morning.
So when we're talking about the overall economy, how's the confidence of the American people right now?
Well, you know, we have a number of measures of the economy from the people's perspective. Classic consumer confidence, we call it economic confidence, is actually getting a little better now than earlier this year. Obama's going to make his State of the Union address, and compared to 4 years ago, it's a lot better, because when he took over in January of 2009, it was terrible, really, in the depths back then. Other measures we have, just 29% of Americans right now say that they are better off than a year ago, and that actually is one of the lower readings on that personal measure that we've seen going way back to the 70s.
What else do we know about how people are feeling about their personal economic situation right now?
Well, we also ask Americans, and this is fascinating, look ahead a year. Do you think you'll be better off or worse off financially in a year from now? And their optimism springs eternal. That's always been the case. We have almost 6 in 10 Americans right now who say they will be better off a year from now than they are now. This is important for Barack Obama. That optimism is a little higher than it was in 1992 and 1980. And those are 2 years where the incumbent president was defeated.
What changes have you spotted in people's attitudes about the economy in the last few months?
General consumer confidence, how's your standard of living measures, those types of things that we track on a daily basis. We are seeing an uptick. We are seeing more confidence coming into the new year. We really had an uptick in that measure. So we think, generally speaking, when the average Jane or John Doe out there is asked about the U.S. economy, they say, hey, things are looking a little better.
Frank Newport is editor-in-chief at the polling firm Gallup. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
The economy is no doubt on the minds of voters in South Carolina, where in just 2 days they will cast their primary votes in the Republican presidential race. Mitt Romney leads in the latest polls, even though many Tea Party supporters see him as too moderate on the issues. Jean Hampton is one of the founding members of the South Carolina Tea Party. She joins us now from Myrtle Beach. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, when this race began, way back when, what exactly were you looking for in a candidate? What did you want most in the next president?
I think it's getting people back to work and creating jobs.
So who have you settled on in the race?
I support Rick Perry's platform because I look at him as really a true outsider from Washington, D.C. I like his idea of a part-time Congress. I think there's way too much government waste. I also support his beliefs socially, conservatively, spiritually, and I like his family values.
All right. Well, then let me ask you this. What if Mitt Romney becomes the nominee? What are you going to do?
I will support the nominee for the Republican Party, but I will expect him to go to Washington, D.C. to support my conservative issues as well.
Anything bother you about Mitt Romney?
I think he is a little bit too unstable in his stance. I know he has changed his mind, which is everybody's prerogative, but I would prefer someone that has been more straight down the line conservative.
What about these ads that are running in South Carolina involving his time at Bain Capital? Are those affecting your view at all?
I know he's a businessman, and sometimes businesses do fail in order to create more growth. You have to go through that process sometimes. So I'd give him the benefit of the doubt on that, since he is more of a business person than I am.
Jean Hampton is one of the founding members of the South Carolina Tea Party. She was speaking with us from Myrtle Beach. Thanks, Jean.
Thank you so much.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
And now the global perspective. In Athens today, Greek leaders are back at the negotiating table with the country's lenders. They're trying to avoid a messy default by figuring out just how much Greek debt has to be repaid.
It's just the latest crisis moment for the euro. And yet, as Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports, ordinary Europeans remain committed to the common currency.
In many ways, the euro has been a disaster for Greece. But Vicky Christopoulou, a restaurant manager in Athens, doesn't believe her country should pull out of the single currency.
I think that I would stay with the euro.
Euro membership is a straitjacket for Greece. It cannot devalue and so make its exports cheaper. It can't grow its way out of trouble. Membership means more austerity. And yet more than 70% of Greeks, like Vicky, still seem to love the euro.
It makes the European Union one. Everybody joining into one group. So it keeps us as a group. So that's why I want it still.
Italy is also suffering from the constraints of euro membership, but most Italians, like Stefania Concilio, a school administrator, also support the euro as a way of bringing Europe closer together.
The European currency is a good tool to make relationship better. So I agree with it and I'm happy for that.
Most Italians say if you're looking for something to blame for the debt crisis in Italy, look no further than corruption and tax evasion.
I think that European currency is not the cause, absolutely not.
Ironically, there's most doubt about the euro in the country that's done best out of membership. Germany has taken half of all the extra business generated by the common currency. But Germans are now among the most sceptical about monetary union. Here's Richard Hessler, a post office worker.
The problem is that Germany has to bail out all the others, you know, and things are getting worse. And I don't see a real solution there.
In one recent poll, 50% of Germans said they'd now prefer to pull out of the euro.
I don't mind us going back to the good old Deutschmark. And I must confess, I still have some Deutschmark banknotes under my pillow. And I'm ready to reactivate them anytime soon.
The return of the Deutschmark is not in the cards, but the waning support for the euro in the zone's biggest, most powerful economy is not an encouraging sign. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
1 second. It doesn't seem like all that much to worry about, just one little tick. But then again, most of us aren't members of the International Telecommunications Union. That's the UN group in charge of syncing the world's clocks. And today, it will decide whether or not to scrap the so-called leap second. As Stacey Vanek-Smith reports, the business implications are far from minor.
The world's computers run on precise atomic clocks, but the Earth's orbit around the sun is not so precise. So an orbit year and an atomic clock year are a little out of sync. Enter the leap second. John Lowe is with the National Institute of Standards and Technology.
Leap day keeps our calendar all kind of in sync. Well, a leap second keeps the rotation of the Earth in sync.
Every year or so, clocks are stopped until they're back in sync with the sun. But there's a push to stop doing that. For one thing, the timing of the leap second is always changing, and it's hard to coordinate businesses that rely on perfectly synced time. Jeff Chester is with the U.S. Naval Observatory.
Just about everything in terms of communication, transactions, use the transmission of digital data.
If those transmissions are off by even a fraction of a second, he says an email or a bank deposit could vanish. Even your GPS uses time measurements to figure out where you are.
So if it's off by a second, it might think I was in New Jersey.
Or it might think you're in outer space.
Chester says most businesses want to forget the leap second, which means clocks would get slowly out of sync with the sun. But the change wouldn't happen until 2018. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
Well, Adrian, President Obama, I don't know if you saw this, has released his first TV ad of the 2012 campaign. And as is required by the campaign finance laws, it ends with this familiar tagline.
I'm Barack Obama, and I approve this message.
Right, we've heard that before.
We have?
Well, it sounds remarkably like the way that he said it in this ad 4 years ago.
I'm Barack Obama, and I approve this message.
Doesn't that sound pretty similar?
It does sound close.
Sounds pretty similar. In fact, I think it sounds exactly like what he said 4 years ago.
I'm Barack Obama, and I approve this message. I'm Barack Obama, and I approve this message.
Now, I know that the president is a busy man. I don't fault him for using a taped tagline, if that's what he's doing. But it does make you wonder if he actually approved the message.
Rupert Murdoch's News International is paying up again over the phone hacking scandal. 19 people will receive payouts after their phones were hacked by the now-defunct UK tabloid News of the World, owned by News International. The actor Jude Law is among them, as well as high-profile UK politicians. The BBC's Sophie Hutchinson is following the story and joins us now for our Midday Extra from London. Good morning.
Hello.
So tell me more about the payouts that were announced today.
Well, this is about 19 claims that were settled in the Civil High Court today here in London. And they included settlements for the actor Jude Law of $200,000. The former Deputy British Prime Minister, John Prescott, he got $60,000. And a footballer, Ashley Cole, got an undisclosed amount. There were obviously others as well. In a statement following today's settlements, Jude Law, the actor, issued a statement and he said that the tabloid newspapers had been prepared to do anything to make money, irrespective of the impact on people's lives. And he described how he had changed his phones, had had his house swept for bugs, but information had continued to be published about him, and that as a result, he started distrusting those close to him. Now, this is the largest tranche of claims that has been settled so far, and it's being seen really as a sign that News International wants to put the phone hacking scandal well and truly behind them.
And that's my next question. Is this News International sort of waving the white flag on this scandal?
Well, certainly some commentators have seen it as exactly that. I mean, it's the largest tranche of claims settled so far, as I just said. And certainly it shows a willing on behalf of News International, which is the UK publishing division of News Corporation that published the News of the World that has found to have hacked into all these people's voicemail messages. Now, by settling these cases, it also means that they will then not go through a full trial, through the detailed examination of a full trial in the courts. But of course, there may be others, and we know that at the moment there are 10 claims that remain unsettled at the moment, and they are meant to be going for full trial in February.
The BBC's Sophie Hutchinson, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And now to pirates, not the online pirates we were talking about yesterday, but real-life traditional sea pirates. A study out today shows that piracy off the coast of Somalia dropped last year. Christopher Worth has the story.
The International Maritime Bureau in London says Somali pirates seized 80% fewer ships in the final 3 months of 2011. Globally, the number of pirate attacks dropped slightly, but pirates are also having a tougher time actually boarding the ships they go after. That's because naval patrols have stepped up their activities and because many ships are now sailing with armed security guards on board. Rory Dowds of the maritime security firm MUSC says the economic costs of piracy still remain incredibly high.
There's been estimates that it could be over $10 billion a year. And so it will take a while before the costs of piracy come down.
Dowd says that's because there's a trade-off. Although ship owners may eventually pay fewer ransoms, the costs for security and higher insurance premiums as a result of the risk from piracy will continue to mount. In London, I'm Christopher Worth for Marketplace.
Southwest Airlines carries more passengers in the U.S. than any other airline, and it's figured out how to make big money doing it. Today, it announced it earned $152 million last quarter, thanks in part to full planes and rising ticket prices. We've got Southwest CEO Gary Kelly with us now. Good morning, Gary.
Good morning, Adrian. Pleasure to be with you.
So the economy seems to be stabilizing. Are you feeling that?
We are feeling that. I think if you go back in 2011, probably mid-year, we were wondering at the time. We had a little bit of inconsistent demand, but the third quarter was very solid. The fourth quarter was very solid, and our trends right now look strong. So all the broader economic news is pretty supportive of that view as well.
Now, for years, Southwest was known as a low-cost carrier, but your prices have gone up. We know that from the earnings report. Has your business model changed?
Well, the world has changed. We're still the low-fare leader. We're still the low-cost producer in the industry. And, of course, now we've grown to serve more customers in the United States than any other airline by far. The main change that we've seen over the past decade is jet fuel. And our jet fuel prices are up fivefold from where they were 10 years ago. So absolutely, that's a big change that has an enormous impact on our overall cost structure. And obviously, we've had to pass those cost increases along to our customers, but you can still look to Southwest to be the low-fare leader.
Now, you also prominently advertise your no-fee baggage policy. Is that a policy that works for the company, and how can you track that?
Absolutely, it works. And again, it's part of our brand. It's part of the way I view our low-fare leadership, the fact that we don't nickel and dime, the fact that we don't charge for things that we believe ought to be free. We provide as much flexibility for changes as we possibly can with our customers, so we don't charge change fees. So there's a long list of hidden fees that our competitors charge that we don't. And it's just part of that trust that we've established with our customers. And how does it work from a business perspective for us? We think we win more customers. And I think, again, the fact that we are far and away the largest airline in the U.S. would be adequate testament to that.
So in addition to your earnings report, Southwest has also made news this week by plans to add an extra row of seats on your 737s. Can you tell me a little about that?
Absolutely. And really the story is we are improving our seats. We're improving the onboard customer experience. They'll be much more comfortable. We'll have the same personal space and room that our seats have today, if not more. It also has the wonderful benefit of us being able to add an entire additional row of seats or six seats. So that has the added benefit of helping us keep our costs down on a per-departure basis by putting six more customers on board. And that helps in keeping our fares low, too.
Now, help me out here, though. How do you add seats but keep people's personal space the same?
Because the seats are different, because the seats are thinner, because you sit differently in the seat, and it allows us to harvest that additional space that's created. So you have basically a thinner back to a seat in front of you, and that creates more space that we're able to harvest by adding this extra row.
As you look ahead broadly to the year for the airline industry, what are you expecting?
Well, we're planning on an improvement in 2012 compared to 2011. We had a number of successes in 2011, but we just weren't able to keep pace with soaring fuel costs. Our outlook for fuel costs this year is better. We're assuming that prices will stay relatively stable, and it'll give us a chance to catch up with those higher fuel costs from a revenue perspective. We have a lot of changes planned to integrate AirTran into Southwest beginning this year. So that'll be a lot of work, and it'll be different. We'll open up Atlanta service. And, of course, we're just beginning to refurbish our fleet along the lines that we've been discussing. We'll be adding the 737-800 model into our fleet this year also. So a number of things are planned, and we're also planning for a better profit performance in 2012.
Southwest CEO Gary Kelly, thanks so much.
Thank you, Adrian. Pleasure to be with you.
And finally, Jeremy, a coming home story gone wrong. Yes. Kitchen company Williams Sonoma was born back in 1956 to a shopkeeper named Chuck Williams in the Northern California town of Sonoma.
Okay, so Williams Sonoma, it makes sense.
Exactly. As the store grew up, it yearned for the big city, like so many of us do, and it moved to San Francisco to make its fortune. Now, five decades later, Williams Sonoma wants to come home, back to its roots, back to Sonoma. But the city council there isn't so sure they want it. They're considering rules that keep big box stores out, even if one of those stores was once their own.
So Williams-Sonoma is not welcome in Sonoma.
Maybe not.
Wow, what a change. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Adrienne Hill. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.